On this week's 51%, a mother experiences the unbearable and then helps others.
You know, one day I just said to myself, okay, I think there's enough sadness. I need to make something out of this.
Rural communities struggle with few OBGYNs around, and meet Mother Banjo. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Not a day goes by, but I don't think of you. I'm always asking why this crazy world had to lose such a ray of light we never knew. Go.
In June of 2017, Amy and Joe Loud of Sandwich, Massachusetts, were completely blindsided. They were about to give birth to their second child, and suddenly, they were having to make a decision for which nobody can really prepare. It's a decision a lot of families do have to make, but not many talk about. Otis Gray brings us this story where one family does speak about it. Just to note that the subject matter may be upsetting to some listeners.
Hey, how's it going, man?
How you doing?
Good, I'm Joe.
I'm Otis.
Otis, how are you?
Joe and Amy Loud live in a Cape-style house in a quiet neighborhood.
Hi.
So nice to meet you.
You too.
They've got two dogs, two cats.
We're a little Dr. Doolittle house.
Oh, and of course, this guy.
My name's Luke. I am turning 10.
No, he's not.
I'm turning 8.
They're kind of this little Norman Rockwell family, which is funny because Amy didn't even always want kids.
No. I did not want any kids for the longest time. And then, of course, when I got older and I met the love of my life, I definitely wanted to have a family.
Guilty as charged.
So in 2016, Amy and Joe found out that they were pregnant with their second son. They named him Landon. And then in June of 2017, they gave birth to Landon.
If you don't mind, do you have any pictures?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Amy brings me over to a shelf with photos of Landon on it, and there's one from a couple hours after he was born. He's swaddled in a little blanket with stripes on it, and the photo is in black and white.
Yeah, it's hard to look at as it is, but looking at it in color is even harder. You can see, like, it's like almost like bruised almost on his face on that side, you know, and his lips are black, and everything is just way more pronounced in color.
One morning, just over 8 months into the pregnancy, Amy told Joe that she didn't feel Landon moving around as much. They figured they'd stop by their hospital, Beth Israel Deaconess, in Plymouth, just to check that he was okay. And as the midwife was giving Amy an ultrasound, Joe saw this concerned look on her face.
I think the way that she said it was, you know, I'm concerned because at this point, we're not hearing a heartbeat. Just everything stopped. Amy was sort of in shock.
We had everything ready. His room was done. All of a sudden, there wasn't going to be a him.
They immediately had to make a very different set of decisions than what they were prepared for. Did they want to deliver Landon by C-section as planned or by natural birth? They had to think about funeral arrangements. And then they were hit with this question.
Did we want to spend time with the baby after he was born?
My immediate thought was no. Almost like I'm in denial, so no, I don't want to see him.
The doctor that I was talking to said that it was something that they would recommend. They said that a lot of people that have gone through this before feel as though that they needed to do that in order to have some closure. And I wasn't sure if we were going to want to have that memory of holding our baby who was dead.
The second that they brought him in, he was just perfect. He looked like he was just sleeping.
You're sitting there holding your son. You're looking at him. You're still asking yourself, am I dreaming? Is this real?
Amy and Joe took turns holding Landon and saying goodbye. After about 30 minutes, they let the hospital take Landon's body so that they could rest before they see him for a second time.
Had we known what was going to change, we would have kept hanging on to him for a little longer that first time around.
The hospital staff took Landon to the morgue to keep him cool. This is the practice in hospitals all around the U.S. They bring the baby to the morgue to preserve the body and then back to the family for brief visits.
When we first saw him, you know, his face was like, you know, had color and was, you know, plumper. And a couple hours later, you know, it was not that way anymore.
Because Landon's body deteriorated so quickly, Amy and Joe only got to see him for about 3 hours total, which means that their family and friends didn't get to say their goodbyes.
And so those are moments that we can't get back.
After they left the hospital, Amy started having anxiety attacks because everyone they knew expected them to have a baby. So Amy and Joe kept having to break the news that he was stillborn. It got to the point where Amy didn't even want to leave the house.
There could have been no lower low. And that went on for months. I was battling with God. And so, you know, one day I just said to myself, okay, I think there's enough sadness. I need to make something out of this.
Through support groups that they were in online, they found out about this thing called a cuddle cot, which is basically a crib lined with a cooling pad that allows families to spend days, even a week, with their child after they've passed, so friends and family can come visit, they can take photos. The cot itself costs about $3,000. 95% of the hospitals in the UK have them, and only 7% in the States do. So Amy started a fundraiser in Landon's name.
And in a flash, we had enough money for one. It was just amazing.
It was almost like a pressure release valve.
Like, these are the memories we're making with him. It's something tangible.
Amy and Joe donated the cot in Landon's name to their hospital. On the cot, there's a plaque that reads, "There's no footprint too small that it cannot leave an imprint on this world." Within 1 week, the cot was put to use. A couple lost their baby at 9 months, and they got to use the cot for 3 full days, allowing their friends and family to come meet the baby. What Amy and Joe found out is that over 60% of these cots in the U.S. are donated by families just like them. Some hospitals don't even give families the option to see their child after they're stillborn.
Why do you think it is that a lot of places don't have these?
I think that what it comes down to, we don't like to think about bad things. Getting a cuddle cot is in some ways planning for the worst. You know, if you think about the way that we treat people's passing that have been with us for any amount of time, there's a whole process that we go through to ensure that people have an opportunity to see the deceased person and to pay their respects. And so why should it be any different when you have a child?
In the months after this interview, Amy and Joe raised enough money for a second cot, and now they had their eyes on a third.
For 51%, I'm Otis Gray.
For years, Missouri's Boot Heel region has only had one full-time OBGYN. That's despite having the worst birth outcomes in the state and one of the highest infant mortality rates in the country. Now the hospital where that doctor practices is closing. Reporter Bram Sable-Smith brings us this piece.
Tasia Welton is ready for her daughter to be born.
She has more clothes than I have. And I'm kind of jealous.
She's got a closet full of pink baby clothes. She's moved into a bigger house, one with room for a nursery. Her baby bag is packed, right down to her daughter's first outfit.
It's really cute.
What's it say?
The princess has arrived. I can't wait to put it on her.
The princess already has a name, Mason. And for 37 weeks, Welton's been seeing the same doctor, Nelson Perez. He's the only obstetrics physician left in this rural region. But Dr. Perez had bad news for her on her most recent visit. The hospital here in Kennett is closing, and his practice along with it.
For the last 2 weeks, I saw every patient, and I told him, I said, you need to find another OB-GYN doctor. You need to be seen.
Perez says he was blindsided by the closure. Sure, hospitals in poor rural communities like this one are closing their doors. But the Kennett Hospital was owned by a publicly traded company. And the last he heard, the hospital had turned a profit. Not a big one, but it's better than the 41% of rural hospitals that lose money each year. Still, Perez says it wasn't enough.
Because in Wall Street, it's not that you make money or not. You don't make enough money for me to invest in you.
Things have moved quickly since the closure was announced on April 30th. Perez's last delivery was May 16th. On May 17th, his last patient left the hospital. Tasia Welton's due date was the 26th. By that time, the nearest obstetrics unit will be an hour's drive on winding rural highways. She's got a car, but many of Perez's patients do not.
I have patients that cannot come to my office and only live 5 miles from here.
Duncan County, where Perez works, is the second poorest in Missouri. It has some of the worst birth outcomes in the state, particularly for black mothers like Tasia Welton. Babies die here more often than anywhere else, and that's with Dr. Perez practicing here, which he won't be soon.
I mean, is this dangerous?
Yeah, super dangerous. We have 3 to 4 probably life-threatening emergency a month.
He's talking about emergencies during childbirth. The only county with worse outcomes is neighboring Pemiscot, the poorest in the state, just 20 minutes away. For years, it looked like the Pemiscot Hospital would be the one to close. They nearly went bankrupt 5 years ago and cut their OB unit to save money. Now, that empty unit and that aging hospital is the only lifeline for Perez's practice. But Pemiscot's chief of staff says that's going to be expensive.
That will cost another at least $500,000 to revamp it.
Dr. Abdullah Arshad says he's working with the state to find the equipment they need at a discount. They're trying to get higher payment rates for delivering babies. And if they succeed, Dr. Perez could be back in practice by July 1st. That's good news for the long term. But what about mothers who are due sooner?
Hello?
Congratulations!
Thank you.
That's an exhausted Tasia Welton sharing a hospital bed with her sleeping princess, Mason.
She was, like, really fussy earlier.
Welton found a new OBGYN about an hour away. But she went into labor before their first visit, so she drove herself to that hospital. And after 20 hours of labor, she delivered.
So I'm, like, really happy. She's so beautiful.
For Welton, everything went right. She beat the odds. And until Dr. Perez's practice opens again, he can only hope that other mothers will be so lucky. Bram Sablesmith, Side Effects Public Media.
This story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a reporting collaborative focused on public health. If you're told your infant has tongue tie, should it be treated? Elizabeth Tracy reports.
Women are encouraged to breastfeed their infants, but a condition called tongue tie, where the infant's tongue may have additional tissue beneath it that reduces its mobility, is sometimes the reason breastfeeding is difficult or impossible. Yet increasing rates of both diagnosis and treatment of tongue tie are concerning. That's according to Jonathan Walsh, a pediatric head and neck surgeon at Johns Hopkins and one author of a recent review of tongue tie.
With tongue tie, I feel like my job is to inform the parents as best as I can, but also to give them realistic expectations that it does help many infants, but not all breastfeeding difficulties are tongue tie. And I think when the mother can make a more informed choice about does she take the risk of this procedure within the first week or 2 weeks of life for her child, that there's appropriate expectations and appropriate management and care team surrounding them to say, hey, if it doesn't work, what's our next step?
Walsh encourages patients to seek out a comprehensive approach to tongue tie. At Johns Hopkins, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
She's known as Mother Banjo. Ellen Stanley is a Minneapolis indie folk songwriter, combining traditional gospel sounds with contemporary Americana. She's a familiar name to acoustic music audiences in Minnesota and beyond. And she spoke with Phil Nussbaum about her Mother Banjo concept.
Come life, come to me. My bones are tired. Work has driven from me all my desire. I can't make it out. The hand is fading. The words on the pages, they have left me.
All my songs come from the banjo. I had played other instruments growing up, played piano, oboe, and dabbled in some other instruments. But really, I never wrote a song I was happy with until I picked up the banjo. And I wasn't very good, but it was just enough to be able to know a couple chords and realize just to bring it back to basics. So all you need is words and a good melody to have a good song, and the arrangements can come later. So really, Mother Banjo is, I came up with that name because it's the source of all my material, is the banjo.
Come life, come to me, the light eternal beckons to me, cannot but follow. I see him waiting, I guess he thought I was with Savior.
We're speaking with Ellen Stanley, also known as Mother Banjo. Now, we just listened to Come Life. That's you in your solo act, but you also play as a duet, a trio, a quartet, a quintet. Where did the band come in your performing career?
Well, it slowly evolved. Right around the time I wrote that song, Come Life, I was playing solo on that album. Swing Low is all pretty much solo material, or maybe one musician. But right around that time, I started performing out with Dan Gorder, who plays guitar and sings with me and still does to this day. And then we slowly built up a band from there, adding mandolin, bass, and adding some electric guitars and some keyboards and more vocals. So now we have a full five-piece band that we've been playing with for about 6 years, and it's really fun to be able to be flexible and play different kinds of music in different ways. It keeps everything really exciting.
I've heard from some solo performers that the reason they go solo is because they don't have to worry about the lead guitar player's family situation. They don't have to worry about the trip some other band member is taking, or someone quitting, or someone, those kinds of situations. So why do you like having a band?
It's funny, we actually have a phrase, a refrain in our band, which Jim Parker, our mandolin player, coined, which is, I love this band! And I think part of it is we do all love the band. We all play in other projects, do other things, but I think what people like about this band is that everyone gets to do something a little different than what they do in other bands. So mainly we just have a lot of fun. But why I like my songs being played with a band is mainly they just get to be fleshed out in new ways. Mainly it's just more fun. I grew up in the gospel singing tradition, so I really like singing with other people, and so being able to make music with people and community is a big part of why I love music, and I think the joy of making that music really comes across in a band setting, because we have so much fun that the audience, I think, responds to that.
We are witness here with friends. We are witness until the end.
Speaking with Mother Banjo, and that's an ensemble recording of the song Witness. You do a lot of religious material. It's not really gospel. It's more spiritual.
It's the kind of gospel music that you can perform for any audience in a bar, in a church, that really speaks to our humanity and how we can live better in community with each other, and also tap into that that higher power that's really around us. And I was raised in the church. My father's an Episcopal priest, so I had a lot of sort of traditional music and gospel music in the church, and I love that music. But I wanted to make music that really reflects both where I am spiritually and that isn't a barrier for other people. Music that whatever your belief system is, that everyone can resonate with the lyrics of We Are Witness, about people coming together and enjoying the moment, enjoying the power of people being together. I wrote it for a wedding, and I think even though it takes on a bigger meaning, I think the concept is really important. I think that thread is really within all of the gospel music that I write.
Through the years and through all the recordings, what's one that rises to the top for you?
Well, there's a lot of songs we've been doing lately that are going to be on the next project that I'm really excited about. But looking back on my catalog, one of the songs that I'm really proud of is a song called The Line. I wrote it for my album Stray Songs, and it's a collection of story songs about sinners, cheaters, and ne'er-do-wells. And this song, actually, my husband, who also plays in my band, Ben Cookfeltz, he has his own songwriting project, and this is the song that he likes to cover of mine, and it's and several other people have as well. But what's funny is that this is the song about cheating, and that's his favorite song to play. But hey, if a fellow songwriter wants to cover any song, I'm good with it. So this song is called The Line.
I pray every day not to bend, that I don't stray.
Mother Banjo plays solo and as a duet, trio, quartet, and quintet. The group is featured in clubs and concerts and also plays for special events, such as, for the last 10 years, celebrating the songs of John Prine. Mother Banjo also plays for private occasions. For information, it is motherbanjo.com. This program is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Phil Nussbaum speaking.
Thousands of women turn cities in England, Northern Ireland, Scotland, and Wales into rivers of green, white, and violet June 10th to mark 100 years since the first women won the right to vote in the UK. Wearing scarves in the colors of the suffragette movement, women marched through London, Edinburgh, Cardiff, and Belfast in events that were part artwork, part parade. The milestone they observed was the enactment of the Representation of the People Act, which in 1918 granted property-owning British women over the age of 30 the right to vote. It would be another decade before women in the UK would have the same voting rights as men. A new study by the organizers of the Elite Davos Forum has found that women don't just trail men when it comes to making money in many developed countries. They're even farther behind when it comes to pensions. The World Economic Forum says the gender pension gap is more than 35% in Europe and the United States, more than double the gender gap in pay, and it's growing. WEF says that the gap is expected to reach $400 trillion by 2050, partly as an effect from women lagging behind men in take-home pay, as well as fewer years on the job on average. Other contributing factors cited include women's tendency to be more conservative with their investments and their longer life expectancy than men on average. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1509.